now our feature presentation.
Welcome to the Movie Goings Podcast, Episode 3. I am your host, Jared Wheeler.
And I am your co-host, Michael Wheeler.
This week, we're talking about The Conversation, 1974 film by Francis Ford Coppola. And since this was my pick, Micah, you go first.
Yeah, so I had actually never heard of The Conversation. Obviously, I've never seen it.
Excellent.
But it is a thriller. I'm just going to read the synopsis off of its IMDb page. So, a paranoid, secretive surveillance expert has a crisis of conscience when he suspects that a couple he is spying on will be murdered. I went in definitely expecting a mystery, a thriller, and it is those things, but it's not a particularly action-packed one. It's more of a character study of this surveillance expert played very well by Gene Hackman, who looks all of 44. who is...
He's 44 and he doesn't look a day over 50.
Right, yeah. I mean, he's a very paranoid character, very lonely, and...
He has lived a full life.
He has, yeah.
Of looking over his shoulder every 5 minutes or so.
Yeah.
I'm glad to hear you say that you hadn't heard of this before, because that was part of the point of me picking this, not to pick a movie that nobody's heard of, but to pick a movie that I think hasn't gotten enough attention, and also to pick a movie that I've really wanted to talk about since I first saw it, and haven't really found a lot of people to talk to
about it.
Nobody's seen it. So,
yeah. So yeah. I'm excited to have a conversation with you about this movie.
So do you have any other thoughts, introductory remarks, or shall I carry on?
No, go ahead.
Okay, well, so as I was saying, the 70s are a decade that I knew very little about when I first started watching movies more seriously in college. And eventually I realized the reason for this was because the 70s was when movies, really great movies, famous movies, were the kind of thing that I would not have seen at home as a kid or even as a teenager. Cinema gets a bit darker. There's a harder edge to it. The production code fell in about 1967, and after that, there were things you could get away with in movies that you couldn't before. And so, the great films, the famous films, a lot of them are very R-rated and just have things that I would not have been exposed to. So,
I also think it's fair to say that these movies weren't available to us in Guatemala. Like, walking into a rental store, I don't think there were many movies from this era in history.
Yes, that's true. But you remember that, we obviously were exposed to a lot of old movies because our parents would record them or get people to record them for them when we came up, or we would kind of grab things off of TCM
True.
Or AMC when we had that available on cable and stuff. And our parents made a point of exposing us to older movies, but that just
to
kind
a
of
certain
ends,
point.
Yeah, in the mid-60s or so. And so as I started to, watch more movies from the 70s, it has become my favorite decade of film. And it's kind of a cliche choice, but it is the most vibrant, I think, decade of movie making that we've had so far in American history. It was a time of, massive change. They call it the New Hollywood. The studio system had fallen, pretty much, and the production code was out of the picture. And there was this kind of idea that the old Hollywood didn't know what people wanted to see, and they kind of were desperately casting around for people who did, and as a result, they kind of handed the reins over to these kind of brilliant young filmmakers who they gave them kind of an unprecedented level of freedom to kind of do whatever they wanted to do, and that lasted until the late 70s or so, when the giant blockbusters like Jaws and Star Wars and Close Encounters of the Third Kind of stuff started kind of driving movie making back into serious business territory again. During this period, you've got Francis Ford Coppola, you've got Martin Scorsese, you've got George Lucas and Steven Spielberg, obviously. You've got a few other directors like Peter Bogdanovich, who aren't as famous anymore, but who have done some really great things. So,
so the conversation, it comes out in 1974. What else was coming out around then?
Well, yeah, so that's the thing about the conversation, because it is, I would say, in my top three of that year, and the other two movies of that year, I think most people have at least heard of, if not seen. So there's The Godfather Part II, which is another Coppola film, and there's Chinatown by Roman Polanski, which is another great, great movie. Mm. So, you know, these are all really great films, but I think that The Godfather II and Chinatown are very well known in comparison to The Conversation, which is sad because I think The Conversation definitely deserves to be in their company. Yeah, it was nominated for Best Picture, actually, and it was also nominated for Best Adapted Screenplay and for Best Sound. And, of course, Coppola lost Best Picture to himself for The Godfather 2, which won that year. And I could say, well, okay, so he didn't, I was thinking, you know, he lost Best Screenplay to himself, but he didn't. He won Best Adapted Screenplay for The Godfather Part 2, and I just said that this was nominated for Best Adapted. It was nominated for Best Original Screenplay. It was his original idea.
Oh, okay. But and he didn't
lost
win that.
It lost to Chinatown, which won Best Original. So, you know, it was obviously eclipsed in the awards by these two giant films. And then it lost Best Sound to Earthquake, which is a disaster movie, which is unthinkable to me because the sound in this movie is a towering technical
it's
achievement.
It's incredibly important as well.
It's integral to everything that happens in the movie, and it is just an amazing achievement, and it's kind of absurd that this, because I haven't seen Earthquake, maybe the sound is super amazing, and who even knows. but it also, you know, was nominated for, Gene Hackman was nominated for a BAFTA and a Golden Globe for his performance, in this movie. And, it was also, the movie was also nominated for, you know, various other awards. I could list them all off, but why bother? It was a big deal at the time, but it wasn't as big of a deal, and it hasn't been as big of a deal later on.
Well, it came out only 6 months before Godfather Part II, so it didn't have a whole lot of time to bask in its success.
Right, but it hasn't caught on as a great classic film the way those other two have either. It's just kind of something that I know a lot of people who watch movies and who have seen it are like, wow, this is really, really great, but it's not something that's part of the popular imagination as much. You know, and if you look at the cast list, you know, there's obviously got a really great, really impressive group of people. Gene Hackman, of course, headlining, and then you've got in very small roles, but important roles, you've got Robert Duvall, you've got Harrison Ford in a pre-Star Wars role, one of the few pre-Star Wars roles he had. And
it's apparently supposed to just be a cameo, but he did so well that they expanded it.
Yeah, that makes sense. I hadn't heard that, but that makes sense. Well, and, you know, Cindy Williams, who plays the woman in this, she been in, yes, the female character. There are more than one, but she is the woman.
She is.
Yeah. There are multiple female characters, but
we'll
she
explain
is the
that.
Woman. So she had been in American Graffiti not too long before this, George Lucas's American Graffiti, and Harrison Ford was in that as well, and Coppola produced that. So I assume that that was how both Williams and Ford ended up on his radar for this movie, because they're both carryovers from American Graffiti.
That would make
and
sense.
And then there's, there was one other, who else? Oh, yes, and then, of course, John Cazale is in this.
Can you, we talked a little bit about this. I think most people who have would recognize him from The Godfather, but why is he,
he's
what is it
famous
about him?
Among people who know about such things because, you know, you say that name and people are like, who? Because he died tragically in the late 70s after having only been in 5 movies in his career. But the 5 movies he was in, all 5 were nominated for Best Picture, and 3 of them won. And of course, he plays Fredo in both Godfather movies. Michael Corleone's older brother, Fredo. And then he was in The Deer Hunter, which won Best Picture in 1978, a Vietnam War movie. And he was in The Conversation, which was nominated for Best Picture. And he was in Dog Day Afternoon in 1975, also with Al Pacino. Which was also nominated for Best Picture. but it did not win. So, yeah, quite the charmed career. And so he's kind of legendary because he is so great, because he basically has what many would call the perfect record as an actor. He has no bombs. He has all massively amazing A-list films and nothing, nothing bad, which is not something really any actor can say, practically.
Right.
So they're all part of this movie. And I guess the other interesting thing to me about this movie is that it arrived at this really bizarre moment in 1970s political history, because it comes out just a few months before the Watergate scandal breaks. And so here we have this movie about wiretapping and surveillance and the biggest political scandal in American history breaks, and it's about wiretapping just a few months later. And people, you know, obviously made the connection, because I think the movie was in theaters as the scandal was blowing up in the news. So I think people were like, oh, so, you know, Coppola managed to hop the zeitgeist on this. But of course, he had been writing this long before, and it was just a complete coincidence that he that he got in there with this, which is so crazy, because there's an actual scene in the movie where, you know, a particularly sleazy character is talking about one of his last jobs, where he was
another
tasked,
surveillance expert.
Yes, where he was tasked with following a presidential candidate from a major political party around the country and, you know, tapping every single one of his phone conversations. And this was, he says, I don't want to say I picked the president, but that guy lost. So, you know, this is very, very much, you know, I don't know if I'd say it's a comment by Coppola on Nixon's kind of slimy veneer even before the scandal broke, but
well, he tried to get this movie made, and I don't know if the script was the same. Maybe, I mean, who knows? But he tried to get this made before Godfather, and he's only allowed to make it after that success. So it could have come
a few years
earlier.
Ticket after the Godfather, yes,
right.
But of course, you know, Nixon was president even then, so.
Still would have been, but not quite as, prescient seeming.
Right. But what I mean is, like, Nixon had that reputation of being a political schemer, even before Watergate. He was just kind of, he was well known as having many lives in the political arena.
Tricky,
his career,
shall we say.
Almost, yes, tricky dick. So, anyway, so that's kind of the context of this movie. That's all stuff that's really interesting to me, obviously, because I care about film history, and I care about kind of the way that it dovetails with American history. But, that's not really what draws me to this movie. Actually, what draws me to this movie is just, you know, I couldn't remember exactly what it was that drew me to this movie. I just remember that it made a very, very powerful impression on me when I saw it, and that I've been looking for an excuse to revisit it for quite some time now, and this provided me with that excuse. And, you know, and thinking about it and rewatching it, it was immediately obvious just from the moment it starts, because I think it sucks you in from the very first scene. And
I mean, it starts with a really amazing long shot.
Oh, I love the first shot. I call it the God shot, you know, where it's way, way above this park or plaza area, I guess. And there's all of these people walking around, and the camera slowly zooms down, and you get snatches of sound from different parts around the plaza, and it tracks down and down and down, and just kind of watching people do stuff. You don't know who's important and who's not yet. You don't know who's going to be in the movie, who isn't. There's a mime who's kind of wandering around messing with people, and he kind of draws the attention, and eventually we kind of settle on Gene Hackman's character from above, and he's obviously kind of standing around trying to be vaguely inconspicuous, and of course the mime kind of settles on him and starts following him around, and he's trying to ignore the mime because he doesn't want anybody to notice him, and the whole time this is kind of a continuous long shot from above.
I can't imagine how hard that shot must have been.
It's probably comparable to the technical abilities that were required of Gene Hackman's character to get the recording that he's getting in that opening scene.
Which his contemporaries don't understand. You know, he at another point he tries to explain to them, and they're baffled that it was even possible.
Yeah, and I want to talk about him in that scene, but we'll get to that, like, I guess, in a second. So the main thing is, you know, so the movie kind of sucks me in from the beginning just because of just the technical prowess is so amazing, and it's immediately just like, wow, what's going on here? And it's kind of holds on to you, and as you get more and more details, and it's clear that there's just so much you don't know, but you kind of grasping at straws, you're trying to piece this together just like his character is, and then, mm-hmm. you know, the ending of the movie is just like a punch to the gut. And it's just powerful and memorable and like, oh my gosh. And when I say the ending to the movie, I mean like there are probably two or three things that happen in the final 15 minutes of the movie that are like multiple punches to the gut.
Yeah, I was going to say, it's boom, you know, you think you know, and then it's more, and then...
You think you know, and you think that it's terrible, and then it just gets worse, and then worse, and
from
then
there,
worse.
Yeah.
So, yeah, just classic 70s cynical bleakness at its finest.
So, that's... We've talked some about the movie quality, but I know that you really enjoyed the soundtrack. Obviously, its use of sound is incredibly important throughout, but I can't say that I actually particularly noticed the soundtrack, but talk to me about it.
You know, I did not remember the soundtrack, so obviously it didn't make that much of an impression on me, I guess, the first time, probably because I was so drawn in by the story, and that was what I remembered, and maybe that's what happened to you too, but... watching it again this time, I was just struck by this kind of weird, haunting, kind of meandering piano theme that floats through the movie. And it mostly, you know, it kind of accompanies Gene Hackman's character, and I think it kind of stands, it kind of symbolizes Gene Hackman's character a bit. And it's just... I just thought it was really evocative. It gives me because it's kind of a noir feel, somehow. I'm kind of a sucker for intricate piano themes like this. So that could be the appeal, but, really great.
Yeah. Let's see. Is there anything else that you wanted to specifically bring out? And just talking about the quality of the film, because it's obviously very high.
Yeah, we talked about Harrison Ford's performance, obviously, and Gene Hackman's performance, and because he creates, you know, just a really amazing character here, and he does a really great job. I think this is kind of, I don't know, I would almost call this the definitive Gene Hackman performance. Like, this is. The character, this is the kind of character I think that he's become best known for playing. And I told you, you know, there's that movie Enemy of the State, which came out in 1998 with Will Smith and Gene Hackman. Yes. And I've seen it a couple times. And, it's kind of regarded as an unofficial sequel to this movie because Gene Hackman basically plays the same character as he's playing in this movie, just like a guy who's like 20, 25 years older than the guy in this movie, because it's that much later. And it has very much the same kind of... a lot of the same themes of, like, paranoia and, you know, somebody's watching you, somebody's out to get you, kind of stuff. It's a more of an action movie, and, you know, it's not as good of a movie by far, but, you know, it's just interesting that they brought him back in for that, because he creates such a compelling character.
Well, and I'm sure that if you were to go back, he played similar characters before and obviously after at least once.
I would have to look at his career before. I know he was famous already for his leading
French
role
Connection.
In The French Connection, yeah. Which won Best Picture in 1971, in which he plays kind of a rough policeman, kind of like a shoot first, ask questions later, you know, punch the villain or punch the bad guys in the mouth before you arrest them, so you can shake them down for a little extra information with some police brutality kind of thing, which is a very different kind of character from the one he plays here.
Right. But this is actually reportedly his favorite role that he's been able to play.
Right, right. So, yeah, that makes sense. So the performance is obviously excellent, and it's it does so much with such kind of a quiet little idea, I guess, mm-hmm. that it just kind of unravels very slowly. And if you look back over the course of the movie, not very much really happens, but it never feels that way because it just generates so much tension. And one of the ways it does that is by slowly unraveling this conversation. It kind of revolves around the conversation. Obviously, the opening scene where we see them recording the conversation, we don't hear hardly any of the conversation. We hear a little bit of it, but mostly we're just kind of seeing them kind of trying to record it, but we don't hear what's being said.
A conversation between a man and a woman.
A conversation, yes, between a couple who think that they are not able to be recorded because they're strolling through this plaza and they're constantly moving through a crowd of people and they don't think it's going to be possible to record them. And that's their intent. They think somebody's trying to record them and they're deliberately trying to frustrate that. So as he's editing the tapes later on, and as he's obsessively listening to their conversation over and over and over again, there's this really great editing technique where as they talk over the recording, it'll frequently flash to show us the scene back in the park, or the plaza, rather. I keep calling it a park, it's a plaza.
Yeah.
Where they're walking around among the people, and it replays little snippets of what they're saying over and over and over again, sometimes in different orders, and to give it kind of different context and stuff. And it plays, it just lets little bitty pieces of it go. Like, you hear a little bit more of it each time he's playing it. Or you'll hear one new piece that you didn't hear before, and
or
you kind of get a clearer and clearer idea. Right, or you'll hear it differently because of what's around it. And each time you hear it, you think you're getting a better idea of what's going on, and of course you're not. So that's just...
really masterful, actually.
It's really masterful, and it's a great... it's one of the best, I guess, movie titles. Like, I don't know, like, I hate titles that are the something... usually, sometimes I think that's.
But what else could it possibly be about?
But,
well, right?
But what I mean is, like, in this case, it's the conversation, and the movie is just all about this one conversation, and that's just amazing.
And the consequences of it,
right?
Okay, so we've talked some about the plot. We've already sort of dipped in a little bit, but do you want to go ahead and issue from now on, our discussion's going to be full of spoilers, and would recommend, if you haven't seen this...
potentially full of spoilers.
Potentially. I don't know how we'll avoid not going
into
it. Yeah,
okay. At some point, we're going to be spoiling this. So, yeah, spoiler warning...
and would recommend that you go see it, because it really does...
it matters.
See it.
It
does
I'm a person
matter.
Who doesn't actually care that much about spoilers generally, and I usually do not mind knowing what's going to happen in a movie before it happens, but there are a few exceptions, and I think this is a movie that really you gain a lot if you don't know what's going to happen. So pause the podcast, go fire up your Netflix account, it's available on Watch Instantly, and rejoin us once you have watched the conversation. Because if you haven't, there's really no reason for you not to watch it. It's amazing.
Okay. Well, welcome back to those of you who have paused and are now back with us.
As all of you did, I'm sure.
Here's hoping. So, Jared, just tell me really quick, just, I gave a brief synopsis, but why don't you briefly tell us, like, about the movie, the plot.
Okay, so it begins with him recording this conversation, and he's been hired by this mysterious figure who is known throughout the movie only as the director, who is this powerful man who he has a really hard time getting a hold of, who's always seems to be kind of gone and busy and is ensconced behind several layers of assistants and receptionists and whatnot in this giant corporation building, he more frequently interacts with the director's assistant, which is Harrison Ford's character. So he makes this recording and he kind of edits it and puts it together and cleans it up and gets it all ready. And as he does this, he starts to get really uneasy about what he's hearing in the recording. He starts to kind of wonder about the motives of the people involved, and he wonders if he's going to cause some harm to this couple. And he's kind of taken... I guess he's gotten a bit sentimental about the couple, particularly about the woman. It seems like he just somehow feels protective of her.
Which we get a better sense as the film goes on, why he feels especially
right. And
responsible
so,
for what
yeah,
comes
we,
next.
We get ideas of kind of his past. There's never anything really explicit. There's a few things laid out slowly over time, but a lot of it still remains kind of enigmatic, and you kind of get enough of an idea without it spelling it out, which is good. His sense of impending doom grows to the point where he's decided that he's not going to give them the recording because he just knows something terrible will happen. And right when he kind of comes to that conclusion, I guess, they manage to steal it from him. And they still pay him for it, but they kind of got the idea that he was getting cold feet, so they send somebody to snag it. And so, in an effort to kind of, I guess, forestall disaster, or at least just kind of prove to himself that everything's going to be okay, he goes to where he knows there's going to be this rendezvous with this couple, and everything, he's really worried for a bit, but then things get kind of quiet, so he's like, oh, that's okay, and then he thinks he witnesses the couple being murdered horribly, and so he's, you know, filled with remorse, but then...
And that scene, I would just note, I don't know of another murder scene that is as jarring in the sound outside
of
Psycho.
I made
Psycho.
A note about that, yes. Yeah, tell me about what you thought of that sound.
Well,
what you noticed about it.
So my wife Laura had just sat down. She wasn't even watching the movie. She sat down with her laptop beside me, didn't have any idea what was about to happen.
And of course you didn't.
Right. And it's pretty quiet. A lot of the movie actually is quiet. I found myself sitting forward at various points, just sort of like listening intently.
Right.
Just like he is.
Right.
And then there's this very jarring moment, and the I don't know if it's violins, but there's this, you know, screeching that is...
Well, it's a sound effect, and it's like a musical cue, but it very clearly has it clearly evokes a woman's scream at the same time. But
right.
It's kind of got this alien, inhuman quality because it's
and
mostly
it just
a
keeps
sound
going
effect,
and going
right? And it's
and
drawn
going.
Out, and it's incredibly unsettling.
Yes, yeah. So I mean, I didn't mute it, but I turned it down like 30 bars. but very effective. He's obviously extremely disturbed and distraught. He feels in that moment that he's failed. And kind of fallen back into what he was trying to avoid in the first place.
So he's in the hotel room next door, and he's walked down to the balcony because they have an adjoining balcony, and there's a frosted glass plate in between his balcony and their balcony, and so what he's seen is this bloody hand go smacking against the window. Leaving this big smearing stain. So he doesn't even stay. You see kind of a vague, blurred figure coming smacking against the glass when the blood gets smeared, and he doesn't stay to look at all at what's going on. He jumps back into the hotel room and slams the curtain shut, and even he dives into the bed and crawls under the covers, which is kind of what you feel like doing.
Yeah, I was going to say, like,
hear that scream.
And cannot blame him.
Yeah, because he's certainly not going to run out of the hotel room. So, yeah, he just, like it's just like he regresses to a little child.
Yeah, so next he breaks, after a reasonable amount of time, there's no more, he can tell no one is in that room anymore. He breaks into it basically, I don't know if it's to prove to himself that what has happened is indeed what he witnessed, or maybe it was a figment of his imagination.
I think he wants to believe that maybe he was seeing, because it's such a brief moment,
mm-hmm.
and I think he wants to maybe believe that he was imagining
mistaken.
It or something.
Yeah.
And it seems like
he
maybe
did.
That's the case, because the room appears to be completely immaculate. He checked. There's a particularly great scene where the camera is inside the shower on the other side of the curtain, and you see him standing on the other side, and he kind of pauses and hesitates as he takes hold of the curtain, like he thinks, okay, whatever I'm going to find, it's in the bathtub. There's going to be blood-stained bathtub, and it's going to be the horrible thing. And he rips it open, and you're kind of half expecting that, too, and nothing. Like, it's spotless.
And it is so intense as well.
Dead silence in the entire scene.
Of what he's about to find.
And very clearly kind of emphasized in the way the scene is shot, there's this very prominent toilet in the bathroom that's got one of those sealed covers over it. And you can see his eyes go to it several times and then look away. Like, that's the last place he wants to really look. But you know he's going to have to open that up.
Eventually.
And once he's checked everywhere else and found nothing, you're like, okay, so he's going to have to check the toilet now. And he opens it up, and he looks, in, and it's completely
it's clean
and empty, too. And for whatever reason, he decides to flush it, and out comes, yeah, and this, and again, incredibly unsettling. It reminds me of The Shining, which I don't know if you've seen.
Oh, right. Yeah, it does, actually. It backs up immediately and starts overflowing.
And this, of course, predates that.
With blood.
Yes, and so the toilet backs up, blood comes kind of
gushing.
Jetting, out, yeah, really. like it's, it looks like, you know, a squid's ink cloud kind of poof out, and then it quickly fills up and overflows, and there's just buckets of blood bubbling over the side of the toilet bowl, flowing out over the floor, creeping towards him as he kind of stumbles backward. And it's just, like, horrifying.
Yeah. I mean, he's frozen there for a minute, but I went back and watched that scene again. It's so well shot, and just put together, and you know, you see the blood starting to near his shoes, and I just want to, like, back up for him.
Right. Yes. You're like, move.
Yeah. So, what happens next? You know, I went, and read, a synopsis online, and they say what happens next is ambiguous. I don't think that it is. But it is confusing because, as we noted,
I still
before
think that it is, and we can talk about that. Go ahead.
Well, as we said, it is a punch to the gut regardless. So of
right.
course we assume that, you know, we've sort of pieced together through the movie that the relationship that exists between the man, the woman, and the director is that the woman is in a relationship or probably married to the woman she's
having.
Well,
there are pictures of her all over his office when
right. So that's a fair assumption. That's what I definitely assumed, that they're married. She's having an affair with this man. They're about to run off. And obviously this whole recorded conversation is very damning. She tells that man that she loves him. And so we assume that she and her lover have come to a very nasty end, you know, somewhere between the balcony and the toilet.
Right.
But what it turns out is that actually they're both still alive. They managed to turn the tables on the director, and he is the one who is.
And when you say turn the tables, you know, we don't even know what his intentions were. Like,
right. They assume, and there is a very important part of the conversation that Gene Hackman's character keeps going back to and
well, it's
hearing
the,
over
it's
and
the
over
key
again.
Line in the conversation, right?
Yeah, that changes over and over. And what is that line, Jared?
It's, he would kill us if he had the chance.
Which it changes, they, you know, the inflection, obviously they go back and do different, the actors obviously do different readings to emphasize different parts. But
well, and throughout the movie, really though, as they piece the conversation together, before the climactic scene happens, it's pretty clear that what they mean is, he would kill us if he got the chance. We need to get out of here because he's going to kill us if we give him the chance to kill us. By the time you get to the end, you realize that the emphasis is he'd kill us if he got the chance. So that's why we're going to kill him first.
Right. Which made me, I guess it made me, and obviously this gives, I think, them a little bit too much credit. But Maybe it doesn't, though. I mean, I assume the conversation is at least partially staged for the benefit of getting this man to show up where they need him to be.
Right, and that's the question, right? Because once once Hackman's character runs into, you know, he goes after he discovers that the murder has indeed happened the way he thought it had. He rushes to the building where the director is and tries to get up and is, you know, shown the door, and he's kind of out on the curb, kind of in despair over what's happened, and suddenly there's the woman that he thought was dead in a car on the curb, and he's just kind of thunderstruck by this, and she gets out of the car, and the man that was with her in the plaza is there with her, and they're being mobbed by reporters, and Harrison Ford's character is there, and he's clearly not at all surprised that the director is dead. Right, the director is dead, and that they are, and they're, all the reporters are talking about how this woman now has a controlling share in the company, and it appears that a very hostile takeover has just gone down, basically. But it's not particularly, it's not necessarily clear who was involved in the conspiracy, or like how far-reaching it was, or precisely how it went down. It's just clear that something really, really shady went down, and this woman, who seemed so innocent and helpless before, seems incredibly predatory all of a sudden.
Yeah. Yeah. And so it's that moment, I definitely had to stop and say, wait, what?
So that's punch to the gut, like, number three, I guess.
Wait, is it three or two?
Well, I would say the first one is when the murder happens, and the second one is when the toilet overflows, and it kind of really drives it home again, and then the third one is, oh, wait, everything we know is wrong.
It's all a lie! Yeah.
So, you know, maybe the conversation is staged, maybe it's not.
There are definitely portions of the conversation that they know that they're being recorded, but there are definitely parts of the plaza that they think that they're safe.
Right.
Certain things are said in very hard to reach places, you know, right beside a band who's playing.
Yeah.
And so I think, and that's where we get that all important line. He'd kill us if he had the chance.
And speaking of, you know, that is kind of the key line, but there are some other lines that kind of jumped out to me. One in particular that they also play over and over again, that I'd forgotten about, where they see that homeless guy lying on the bench, and the woman's basically like, oh, that poor man. And, the man that's with her says, he's not hurting anyone. And she says, neither are we. And it's so weird the way she says that, I guess. And so kind of the meaning that you kind of take from that is, you know, we're just in love. We're not hurting anyone. I wish that we would just be left alone. But, then, you know, obviously it takes on a very different connotation later when they end up actually hurting someone. Because she says, neither are we. And then she says, oh, God. And she kind of goes on in this kind of rambling thing about the homeless guy and how when every time she sees a homeless man on a bench, she imagines him as a baby with a mother and family who loves him, and she wonders how he ended up where he was. And this really, like, deep empathy that she feels for people that most people don't feel empathy for. And so kind of that turn that happens later is so strange, like, that she ends up taking a human life. It's obviously set up in a way that's the last thing you would expect to happen.
Right. And for her to be involved, certainly.
Right.
Yeah, so that is gut punch number three, I guess we've decided. So
yes.
Now Gene Hackman's character returns home, and a running point throughout the film is that he, of course, as we've said, is extremely paranoid, very, very private. He believes that nobody knows his address or even his birthday, And he does have a phone, but no one is supposed to know his phone number. And he arrives home, and his phone begins to ring.
And he even claims to everyone that asked that he doesn't have a phone.
Yes. Yeah, so he answers the phone, and it's Harrison Ford's character, the now very shifty assistant to the director, now deceased.
He was a pretty shady guy before, but now he's like...
Yeah, now he's ultra shady.
Shady and a half, yeah.
Yeah, and I think it's because of his involvement that I was, I think, most confused. I was like, wait a second, I really thought he was on the other side of things. Anyway, so he calls, he informs, of course, Gene Hackman's character that, they know that he knows... he better not get involved, and informs him that they'll be listening to him, and then goes on to play a sound clip of Gene Hackman's character playing some jazz music. The character plays what is it that he plays?
Saxophone.
A saxophone. Yeah. So very distinct, obviously. And so Gene Hackman kind of loses his mind and begins looking for that listening device.
Right. So he's the final scene of the movie. He tears his apartment completely to shreds. I mean, completely. Like, he tears up the floor and tears out the wall. Several hours.
Several minutes of
time. He dismantles all of the furniture, smashes most of his personal belongings. The only thing that he doesn't destroy basically is his saxophone. Because then, the final shot is of him sitting in the rubble of his apartment,
very
having unsuccessfully, having not found the bug and, is kind of playing the saxophone and the credits roll. So that's kind of gut punch number four.
Actually, that's not gut punch number four. Gut punch number four is the camera movement. So we see earlier in the film, he is at a surveillance conference. He's looking at all this brand new technology, which is a really fun part of the film, actually, because it's kind of funny to see what was considered incredibly high tech at the time.
You say funny.
It's not in within the movie, but it's like I can't help but think of all the ways that those things are just massively.
What's funny about it, I guess, is the way we see that scene now, literally 40 years later, and how it reads as like just a giant room full of massively retro technology, whereas it would have looked almost futuristic to an audience in 1974.
Like, I can't believe this exists.
Right. Like, yeah, exactly. Because this is the cutting edge that they are showcasing.
So again, going back to that last scene. So at this expo, he gets a chance to play with a brand new surveillance camera that can be moved with a remote. And so the last scene of the movie, the camera sort of starts in a corner, the opposite corner from where Gene Hackman's character is, and slides toward him in a camera movement that we're used to seeing all the time. So it slides over, showing us, just how far he's gone and ripping. Yeah, it pans over, showing us just how his apartment is just rubble now.
In ruins, yes.
And shows him... and then pans back, and I remember thinking, wait, why is it panning again? What's it going to show us? And it doesn't show us anything. It just goes back to the first corner, and then it pans back to him. So it mimics the movement of a security cam.
That's interesting. I had not. So you think that there is a camera?
Yes. Yeah. And that is what he couldn't find. And not only is he being listened to, he's being watched in his own home. Which is, of course, the ultimate intrusion for anyone, but certainly for his character, who has gone the entire movie believing, and we've believed him as well, that he's been perfectly secure. No one knows, you know, anything about him, or, you know, much less where he lives. And all along, he's been watched.
I'm not sure I buy that, but I'm not going to rain on your parade.
Fair enough. I was just like, what? Mind blown.
But yeah, so you know, the ultimate end of the movie is, you know nothing, you have no control, there is evil and injustice in the world, and you are powerless before it. Which again, as I that is a classic theme of 70s films. It's actually it's very very reminiscent of the ending of Chinatown, as well. In a way. So, yeah, just really, really stirring stuff.
And I know this isn't the theme of the movie, but I couldn't help, you know, again, watching it now, 40 years later, with all the surveillance scandals that are in the news now, obviously.
The NSA, yeah.
I, you know, especially as I was watching that first scene, and how this couple, you know, believes that they can't possibly be heard at this moment. Watch the lengths to which they go to record this couple, and it's extremely difficult. I just couldn't help but think, even as I was watching that scene, wow, like if it was that hard now, I mean, it's got to be just a snap. at this point, which is
right. If in 1974, one of the themes of this movie, or one of the recurring things that comes up over and over again, is nowhere is safe. The thing, Gene Hackman's character is a celebrity, a major celebrity in the surveillance world in this movie, because of a job he pulled off many years before, where he was able to record private conversations on a yacht out in the middle of the ocean. And it's a mystery to everyone how he did it. And so, you know, the point, I guess, is that if you were not safe in 1974 from this kind of intrusion, how much less safe are you now?
Yeah. Yeah. So that was definitely, one of the more disturbing aspects of the film to me, but I wonder if it would have been to the same extent then, because I wonder if it played almost like science fiction at the time.
It's possible. Yeah, I think that at the time it would have been regarded more as, I guess, symbolic of kind of the wheels of, whether it be corporate or government, or whoever is in power, who can kind of just do whatever they want, go wherever they want, listen into whatever they want. So, you know, hopefully you can stay off their radar, but no matter how hard you try to stay off their radar, if they spot you, like, and that's one of the, I guess, that was what I was thinking of earlier, when you were talking about the amazing technology here. That's one of the things in Enemy at the, I keep saying, what is that, Enemy at the Gate? Enemy of the
Enemy
State.
Of the State.
Not the Stalingrad epic. Enemy of the State, where it's not audio surveillance, it's satellite surveillance, where the government has these satellites that are basically able to zoom in to an absurd level of detail anywhere on the planet at any time. So, like, Will Smith's character is running away at one point, and the government basically has a zoom shot of him, like, at all times. They know exactly where he's going at any moment. As long as he is outdoors, they can see him from the sky. So, you know, look up and wave, because the government's watching.
So, we've talked a lot about, at this point, various aspects of the film that we enjoyed. Obviously, it is extremely well made. And, you know, actually, not only is it Gene Hackman's favorite film role, It's also Francis Ford Coppola's favorite of his own films.
Really?
Yeah. So, having
I would imagine he feels a lot of ownership of it too, because this was his original idea.
Right, had to fight so hard for it.
But you know, he wrote, directed, produced. It's The Godfather, you know, was assigned to him, I believe, and you know, of course, he adapted it from somebody else's work. And he shared the writing award for Godfather 2 with Mario Puzo, the author of the novels. So, so this is definitely something that is his.
And all his.
Yeah.
Right. So, we've talked a lot of, about the plot as well, sort of unraveled it, full of spoilers for everyone at this point. So, as we wind down here, let's take a few minutes to talk about the character played by Gene Hackman, and I guess we should have just said his name
Harry Call,
way
yeah,
earlier.
We should have been calling him Harry Call instead of Gene Hackman's character all this time. That's okay.
Yeah, so Harry Call. And that's Call, C-A-U-L, not C-A-L-L.
Right, right. So yeah, it is, you know, his character is really, really great because there are so many layers to his character, and we don't even begin to kind of go through them all, I guess. You'll peel back maybe a tiny corner of one layer to see that there's another layer underneath at different points in the movie. But we don't even begin to kind of get to really the heart of this guy, I think.
I just really want to quote Shrek right now, but I will.
Yes, he's an ogre. He is kind of an ogre, actually.
Actually, yes, he is.
So, obviously, we've talked a lot about his expertise in his field, his extreme paranoia. I've mentioned that he's basically a celebrity within the surveillance world, which is very uncomfortable for, like, you can tell he enjoys it, but at the same time, he doesn't particularly enjoy the attention. He does and doesn't. And that's, I guess, one of the things about him, because one of the few scenes in the movie where he appears happy to me is when they're having that kind of party after the expo, mm-hmm. where they've all gone up to his work area, and John Cazale's character has told everyone about the job that he just did that was super impressive, and they all want to kind of hear about it, and he starts explaining all of the technical aspects. And so, you know, here's a crowd of people who actually understands what he's talking about and can appreciate kind of his genius. And this is obviously his passion in life. And he just gets really, really excited and kind of has this big childish grin on his face as he's explaining kind of what he did and how he put it together and how amazing it was. And
it stops and just short of actually giving them the goods.
Right. But I think that's one of the only scenes in the movie where kind of the mask comes off and he's showing other people kind of his true emotions.
Yeah, it's really odd, actually, because we don't see it before or after. Yeah, it definitely stood out to me at the time. I kind of wondered if he was playing them, but he's not.
No.
He just can't help himself.
Right. Because he doesn't get to let his guard down like that. And, of course, I guess the tragic thing about this scene is that he experiences kind of a betrayal, or he certainly regards it as an incredible betrayal. And so, you know, the mask just clangs back into place. So he's hanging out with this woman who was one of the, I think they call them booth babes now, but you know, like the attractive woman who shows off the merchandise as the man is talking about it at this expo. And she's kind of gone back with him along with a few other women. So he's hanging out with this woman and they've danced and stuff, and they're off kind of by themselves, on the other side of the room from everybody else. And he's kind of quietly talking to her about, she doesn't know this, but he's talking to her about his girlfriend.
We haven't really talked about,
yeah, we should definitely mention that because, well, we should at least mention because, what is the deal with her? There's one scene with his girlfriend, who's played by Terry Garr, who's kind of a famous 70s and 80s actress. And, you know, he goes to visit her early in the movie and on his birthday, and they start to get kind of intimate, but she keeps kind of bothering him with personal questions, and it kind of knocks him out of the mood, and he just gets up and leaves. And she kind of says, you know, don't bother coming back, basically.
I'm not going to wait for you anymore.
Right. And it's kind of an opportunity for him to be like, okay, I'm sorry. And he kind of pauses and thinks about it. But his privacy, I guess, is more important. And he walks out.
And it's not even intense questions that she's asking him. It's just basic, get to know you, build relationship kind of questions.
Because it's like, you know, she's like, oh, I didn't know it was your birthday. And then he lies to her about his age. And and she's asking him stuff like, you know, what do you enjoy doing and this and that. You know, it's just like, I like you and I want to know more about you kind of questions. And he's just
not having it.
Yeah, he's incredibly uncomfortable with it. And she also points out, you know, obviously there's already a problem with their relationship, because she points out that whenever he comes to visit her, she always hears him kind of creep up to the door and slowly, quietly slip his key in and then fling the door open really suddenly and step in like he's trying to catch her doing something, which is almost certainly what he's doing.
Yeah, he expects betrayal.
Right, he trusts no one ever. Because that's the business that he's in.
So going back to his conversation with the booth girl, back at the party, he, begins to open up to her about that relationship, though she doesn't know it.
It's floating as a hypothetical question to her. Like, if you were in a relationship with a man and you wanted this to happen and you were saying these kinds of things to him, mm-hmm. but he didn't want to do this and blah, blah, blah. And he's kind of trying to get a woman's perspective without having to open himself up to anyone. He's trying to have a conversation with his girlfriend without actually having to have his girlfriend in the room. So he doesn't have to open himself up to her.
And doesn't get anywhere.
Totally hypothetical. Right. He doesn't get anywhere because she doesn't get it. But what
it's a really confusing situation anyway.
Is that the sleazy booth guy who had come back with him that he kind of has some tension with already had given him a pen, and the pen is bugged and it's sitting in his pocket. And as a joke, the guy pulls out his recorder and starts playing back the conversation that he was having with this woman at the time. And of course everybody thinks it's a big joke because he's the master bugger and he got bugged. And I don't even think that they all think that kind of his pride is wounded because he got one up on him. But it's not that; it's that he's really kind of revealing himself emotionally in having this conversation with this woman and trying to figure out what to do about his girlfriend, and he got recorded and he cannot handle that.
Yeah.
So he throws everybody out, and just kind of seals himself back inside his little vault.
I mean, that part really struck me because, I mean, it's definitely a symptom of what he does, but it's also, I mean, it's just ironic that he is so private when that's what he does for, for his livelihood is do that to others, like completely, you know, reveal others to the highest bidder, as it were.
Right. Well, and I mean, it is ironic, but it is also the explanation for why he is the way he is.
Right.
Because he makes his living off of revealing everyone's deepest, darkest secrets. He is all the more careful about guarding his own. So
there's
kind
also
of done this to himself, I guess.
There's a really confusing aspect of his character that we definitely should talk about, and that there's this really interesting faith aspect that we first
become.
He's
a deeply religious character.
Well, we first become aware of this when his assistant says. You know, he curses, he says Jesus, and
he doesn't curse, he takes the Lord's name in vain, and then does it again.
Right, and I was like, Gene Hackman's character.
And both times, Harry's like, stop, like, seriously, stop doing
that
right now.
No, I don't like it when you do that. Please don't do it again.
So, this comes up a couple times in the movie where somebody basically blasphemes in his presence, and he, you know,
really bothered.
It's just like, you need to not do that anymore. And then, of course, there's the scene where he goes to the church to confess. And this is kind of when he's having this crisis of conscience over what to do about this recording. And as we learn later on, this job that he did that he's so famous for resulted in some innocent people being horribly killed somehow.
A family.
Yeah, a family. And so, you know, he is kind of haunted by that. And that's part of what's driving his crisis of conscience now. Because it's clear that before that happened, he didn't think a lot about what people did with the recordings. And he still kind of tries to be that way. He still kind of talks the talk. He's still just kind of like, you know, this is the job I do. I'm hired to provide a service. And what people do with that after I'm done is none of my business. And I don't care. But he clearly does care.
He is listening very carefully, and I would assume that a call like this hasn't come his way since the one that, you know, that we hear about.
This is the first time that he's been able to kind of, I guess, lull himself back into, you know, this is the job that I do, and I don't worry about the consequences. And this is the first time that he's in a situation again where he's like, wait, this could be a repeat of that horrible, horrible thing. So he goes to the church and he goes into the confessional and he says that it's been 3 months since his last confession. So he obviously, I mean, that's not super regular, but you know, he does go sometimes. And I have this written down kind of what he says. He says, you know, he kind of reels off some of his minor sins, kind of beating around the bush, I guess. And then he's like,
he hasn't been to confessional for what, like, a couple years or something like
no,
that?
No, he actually says, and I wrote this down, or otherwise I would have thought that it was a couple years. He says 3 months. It's been 3 months since my last confession. But he says, people were hurt because of my work. And I emphasize the transition between the word murdered into the word hurt more than he does. It's really, really subtle. But if you listen, like, he starts to kind of say the M sound, people were, and then smoothly kind of flips it into hurt, to where you could miss it if you were listening for it almost. Because of my work, I'm afraid it could happen again, and then he kind of goes, he kind of starts stammering. He's like, I was in no way responsible. I'm not responsible. And then he's like, and for these and all of the sins of my past life, I'm heartily sorry. And he kind of gets up and leaves. So he kind of starts to tell the priest what's bothering him, but he can't go through with it, and he can't really say it, and he kind of seals himself back up. He's like, wait, but no, I wasn't responsible. That wasn't my fault. And this wouldn't be my fault. And forget this. I'm not doing this. So yeah, he's obviously just kind of running himself ragged in circles in his head.
Yeah. He can't admit it to himself, much less another person.
Right.
Okay. Well, Jared, I want to go ahead. I think that I've said all I have to say about this movie. Do you have any closing remarks?
Just that you should all go out and see The Conversation and enjoy it. Hopefully you have already if you've listened this far, but you know, definitely check it out.
It won't be on Netflix forever.
A great classic film from 1974, and I think, you know, it's one of the great movies of that year, and really, really good stuff. I highly recommend it.
Agreed. Thanks for sticking with us, and I hope that you will join us next time.
Yeah, yeah. So, until next time, this has been the Movie Goings Podcast. Thanks for joining us.